Blog Talk Radio.
Paolo Nzili was castrated, Wambugo Wanyingi was beaten, Jane Muthoni Mara sexually abused. Their torment happened years ago in a detention camp. But on Friday, they had reason to smile. They'd won a battle in Britain that could make history. This court ruled the trio can sue the British government for damages. The judge said a fair trial is possible, that, quote, the government and the military commanders seem to have been meticulous record keepers. And the records are gruesome. The three had been swept up in the Mau Mau rebellion against British rule in the 1950s. It was a cruel and bloody uprising in which tens of thousands died, and many more detained, tortured, raped, and maimed. The trio won Britain to fund welfare benefits for other torture victims, and to say sorry. The British government has conceded the Mau Mau were tortured, but says too much time has elapsed to allow a fair trial. And if the British government wanted to spin this out, it knows time is on its side. The three Kenyans are in their 70s and 80s now. When they started this case, there were four of them, but their friend, Ndiko Mutua, didn't live long enough to hear he'd won. Robin Creel, Nairobi, Kenya.
They say they want to live their last days in dignity, after having endured the scars of torture for more than 50 years. And their lawyer says the British government is failing in its moral duty by not opening up about the past.
The history of what happened to the Mau Mau in Kenya during the 1950s at the hands of the British is a very sorry and distressing tale. It is, however, a tale that has to be told, if we as the British people are to learn from the mistakes of the past.
The British crushed the Mau Mau by moving tens of thousands of people into detention camps, where they carried out widespread abuses. The Mau Mau themselves also committed atrocities. The British government argues that the uprising caused a great deal of pain for all sides. The British government's defence is expected to be rather technical. It's likely to argue that so much time has passed that this case should not now proceed. But that will not satisfy Britain's critics in Kenya and elsewhere, who say this country is not taking responsibility for some of the darkest deeds of empire. They want an apology and compensation, but they are old, so time is not on their side.
The picture that emerges is that the British government is aware that these victims are in their 80s and 90s, and they are buying time in order for all of them to die out.
After the end of the Mau Mau emergency, Kenya became independent. For decades that followed, British and Kenyan governments had a tacit agreement not to examine the past too closely. Now, as the claimants get their chance to tell their story in court, the past is bubbling up again, and ugly truths may emerge in the days ahead. Barnaby Phillips, Al Jazeera, at the High Court in London.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Fire Talk Production. My name is Nell Cole, and I'm your host. I'm excited today to have two very intelligent guests who I'm sure are going to give us a lot of information that we can compare to what we're also living in our world. So, welcome today. We have Esther and Charles. Esther, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Greetings.
Greetings. Welcome. Can you tell us a little about yourself?
Okay. Well, greetings, listeners. I'm Esther Stamford Jose, and basically I am a reparations activist, which is called a reparationist. I'm also a jurisconsult, which is a specialist in applied jurisprudence, the science, philosophy, and the study of law through its actual practice. I also am a broadcaster on Britain's only licensed African community radio station called Voice of Africa Radio.
Charles, are you there?
I am indeed, yeah.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Greetings.
Can you tell us about yourself as well?
Yes, my name is Charles Wainaina. I am a Kenyan living in London. I'm a civil engineer by profession for so many years. Apparently, my connection with the court case on Mau Mau is once the court case came over here, we formed a group calling ourselves Mau Mau Justice Network, which with the aim of being able to give a drum up support for the court case, awareness, and also be supportive of the elders when they come here during the court hearing. And that's how I'm involved, and Esther has been such a mentor for us in terms of understanding issues of reparation and claims and so forth.
So how did you two get to know each other?
Wow. It was just through finding out about the Mau Mau Justice Network. In fact, they had a screening of this film that was about this Kenyan who was a Mau Mau who ended up waging a struggle against the government to be educated. And they asked me to be a panel member, and so that's how I actually became familiar with the Mau Mau Justice Network. And from there, have been working collectively with them in terms of trying to build a solidarity movement and look at the broader implications of the case that is, for reparations for three survivors of torture in the period of the Kenyan emergency.
And Charles, can you give us a little history about how British occupation happened and what influence it had on your people?
Oh, yes, certainly. Bear with me on that. The way the Mau Mau movement came about, which I'll explain in a little while, was the onset of the whole issue rises when the colonialists came to Africa. They sat down in Berlin conference, as it referred to, 18-something, and they drew a line, which they call boundaries, and they divided the whole communities all of Africa. That's the scramble for Africa. From there came the Second World War, and our people went to support the British army in Burma, which is Malaysia nowadays. And after these people came back home, our elders, they realized that when they came back home, they were now serving the very people that were fighting along together. They now became masters. How these colonialists came to Kenya, they were rewarded by virtue of being in the war. They were rewarded with chunks of tracts of land out there in Kenya, and therefore these our elders started working for them. So you can imagine some used to have land, so much land out there. You end up owning just a small piece of land, less than an acre, and you're working on this plantation, whatever it is, you're cultivating all these crops, and they're being sent overseas. And I find that fermented the bitterness, the injustice. So little did the colonialists know that a movement had been formed at that time, which was way back in late 40s, early 40s. And this kept on going for almost about 5 years without them knowing. Initially, our people were called themselves the Land and Freedom Movement. That's what they wanted. So eventually when it became an armed wing, it became as the Kenya Land and Freedom Army. But later on, and the history now knows that these people now called, they were now being referred to as Mau Mau, which is another connotation of, these are two names, two separate names, Mau Mau. Initially, being coined as it's a Swahili word. Swahili is the most widely spoken language in Africa, and literally means the white man to go back to Europe and the African to obtain independence. That's Mau Mau, meaning Mzungu aende Ulaya. Mzungu means a white man or European. Aende, go back. Ulaya, Europe. Mwafrika, that's the African. Apate, again, Uhuru, which is independence. So that's how the movement came about, and that's what we've been referred to as Mau Mau. But from there are quite a lot of issues surrounding how we were dissatisfied with the way our land was taken. We were robbed of everything, name it, our governance, our way of life, I don't even know how to put it. And today that still shows in every society back in Kenya. All these internal wrangles, fightings, what have you got, is a result of this, because not everybody was for this movement. They were collaborators who even today are actually the leader or the rulers in the country. And they
right.
have they got all the spoils.
That's very common to happen, is that, you know, collaborators work with the government trying to occupy, and they become wealthy, are the tribal leaders or whatever, and the real people who are being put down don't have any form of justice at all.
True, true.
So were there laws passed to prevent them from doing certain things?
Oh, we were literally, there were three categories, I would say, in the struggle for freedom. We had the people who went to the forest. Those are the ones who grew the dreadlocks and all that, because that's the way of life that was out there in the bush. Then we had the people who were actually, who took the oath to collaborate with the people in the forest who are the fighters. So the colonialists went around getting these people, gathering them together, and then were put in villages. This is what the onset of villagization in Kenya. Then we had the other group that was actually put in concentration camps, and that's one where the horrors were committed. Horrors were committed, crimes, atrocities were committed, both in the villages and in the detention camps or concentration camps. They call them detention, but I probably call them concentration camps. It's very, very painful to listen to these elders narrating, describing what they went through. And I know I've talked to one myself, and that's one of them is Wambogo Nyinge. He's an elder, a person, and it's really hard. So you don't want to listen to some of the stories, but we have to tell the story. We have to listen to it, because without them, we wouldn't be having the freedom we have in our country and in so many other countries around the world.
What is the knowledge that the youth have of this movement? Do they understand the history of it?
In terms of, I do understand, personally, I don't like to brand myself, I'm a Kikuyu like them, because most of the people that actually suffered were the Kikuyus, but the movement was not meant by the Kikuyu tribe only. It was all over. It was for the whole country. We got other tribes who got involved into it, and very, very deeply, very much into it. And the whole idea behind it was just to make sure that we fight the injustices. We wanted to claim back our culture, our land, our freedom. That's what
right.
what all it was about.
Now, was it in the 50s that they were put in these concentration camps?
The whole idea was divide and rule. You know, when people had been taken away from their ancestral land and they were taken to the Rift Valley, especially, where that's one of the most very, very fertile land out there. That's where they grow the tea and some coffee and name it. And the best place where you can actually have one of the best places to actually grow a cash crop like wheat and what have you. So we were taken out there. I myself witnessed, to be honest, I was just about 5 years old when the emergency rule was declared, rather ended in Kenya. I used to witness my elder brothers leaving the house in the evening, going to sleep in the bush, because if they are found there, because they will come around the map in the night. And if they are caught, then they will be taken into the concentration camps or villagization where they are forced to work, really very forced to work. I know very well. They used to work those farms, and all they used to get at the end of the day, that was the late 50s and early 60s, was just a pound of sugar, I think 2 pounds of, there was no metric system there. Those days what was pound and ounces. And you get some sugar, some tea leaves, and of course you get free milk because they had all the dairy cattle and all that, and you get some maize meal. That's enough for your family. And you're portioned according to the size of your family. It's some of those things you can't believe. They still affect us today, because we were denied, our land was taken, we never had nowhere. So even now, today, we are still at disadvantage, those people who are in concentration camps, because they didn't have no means to educate us. And I know I can tell you more about my case. I didn't come to where I am on a silver lining plate, no.
So you're like the next generation behind them. What effect does seeing your brother have to do these things and seeing all the things going on around you have on your life now?
It did have a lot, because I know twice I had to drop up out of school because there was no money to further my education well, while my older brothers were going to secondary school and so forth. It's been a struggle throughout.
Now, but were any of your brothers put in these camps at all?
Sorry?
Were any of your relatives put in these camps?
Yes, yes. My oldest brother was, yeah. My oldest brother. He's the same age like both of them. He's still alive, 83. He'll tell you all about that. Yeah, he's still alive.
But he's not one of the ones that's doing this case right now, correct?
Well, he's not one of the claimants, but yes, you be aware, the number of people out there who actually fall in that category are in thousands. We have got an association back in Kenya called Mau Mau War Veterans Association in Kenya, which does take care of that. They are already being registered, and this case will set the precedence as to what's going to happen to them.
Oh, okay. So everybody's watching. Now.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Are the elders now that are doing this court case, are they toward the higher end of the age, or are they about average age? Like, is that the same age that your brother is, in the 70s or 80s?
Most of them are in that age group. From about 70, you can imagine, those people who are 17 years, something like that, at that time, 20 years, and that's around 1940-something, late 40, early 50. So you can imagine now, this is 60 years on, and they were about 27 and so forth. So they are around that age. So you can sort of, you know, just take an age group between maybe 15 to 25, and you can group all them in that from about 75 to about 90. But most, the ones who are a bit older have since, left us.
Right. It's a very difficult thing to do when you get in this age group. Now, you said they had to travel to London, is that correct, to go to court case from Kenya? And how far is that?
Yes. Oh, God, that's a direct flight from Kenya to Nairobi, Kenya, to London is 8.5 hours. And that's what they endure. You can see they suffer even when they land here. We are here for them, to give them the moral support. It's a jungle to them, which they have never been to, and it doesn't look very familiar. It's not familiar at all.
So they've never been, like, into the city? Is that what you mean?
No, they are not travelers. Some of them have not even been to the city, Nairobi city itself. So probably they went there for the first time to get their papers processed so they can travel. They are local people in the villages. We just humble people. You meet them, very friendly. They're always very happy to talk about, not happy, but they are more than happy to tell people about what they went through and why they should stand up. The spirit of Momo is very, very strong.
How did these elders come to be the ones, out of all the other people, to be the ones to be doing this case?
I think from what I gather, as they are being represented by Kenya Human Rights Commission, this is a test case whereby they had to take real people who have got evidence, cards, who can actually narrate everything about what happened. And that will set a precedent, as I say, will set a precedent to what's going to happen to the others, because everybody suffered. You asked me today, I suffered.
Right. Now, what is your feeling when they say it's been too long to do a case properly?
To me, that is just wishy-washy. You're just trying to find a way out. It's not gonna wash, to be honest, because we have known of various other cases like the Holocaust, the Jewish Holocaust. They're still being
right.
Japan is still paying today, so why this statute of time limitation that should not at all be mentioned? Wrongs committed are wrongs committed; they don't go away with time whatsoever.
What do you say about atrocities that were committed on both sides?
I think you asked me that's a very good question. How would I be responsible if a person came to my house or to my compound and decided to humiliate me or sit on me? I'll definitely rebel, and I'll be up in arms. So I don't know who invited them. They came over there, and then they claim to have been the discoverers of whatever these natural resources are there.
Yeah.
How we knew they were there. We knew the purpose. They destroyed them. Animals, our livers, whatever. I mean, I don't want to go. I can go on forever. It's not. They should not ever even say, okay, people. They oppressed us. They made the colonizers. They made us subhuman. If we knew our ways, we had our own culture, our own governance. We knew how to live. We had our own crops. Foreign crops were introduced to us, and that's why we've got all these diseases out there today. But before, we lived a very happy life.
Now, how did the children, because normally the first thing they do is try to get control of the children and their education. Did that happen in Kenya as well?
Yes. I'll be honest with you, and you can quote me. Very few at that time. The only people that had good education or actually had that sort of opportunity to study and obtain education were the children of the collaborators. We know very well, like of late President Jomo Kenyatta, he married into the family of the paramount chief at that time because we had tribal chiefs. He married into that, and that's why the man got compromised. He had this good vision, but he got his loyalty got compromised, and that's why we are suffering today. Because all those people have got all the best land, whatever you may want. Education was they were given freedom passes to where they wish to go, and you can recall. And I read in one of the books by Paul Robeson, which is Here I Stand. There were restrictions that you could only be given a passport to go to one country only, not like move around. So that's if you are that lucky. But we were not lucky even to venture anywhere outside our villages. We studied there, we don't even know beyond. And that they indoctrinated us with the kind of education they knew was going to suit their ways of progression, not ours.
Did religion play any factor in the education of the children?
Come again?
Did religion play any factor in the education of the children or what happened in your society?
It's painful to say the least, and how this, because we never, I will say we got education, but if you come and teach me, for example, I was a lecturer one time, and the syllabus we were using was a long syllabus. In Africa, we don't need to build cavity walls, double leaf walls, and that's what you're teaching. I rebelled against it. I say I can't teach that kind of syllabus because we were not taught about our history. We were learning about other histories outside of our own, and we had to teach ourselves everything that we had in terms of culture, education that we could have actually been doing it ourselves. We were being taught foreign ideologies that were not suited for our system way of life.
Right. What about your language? A lot of times they come in and try to take the language. Did they try to do anything toward taking your language away?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The official language was English. We had to learn. That's a must. It had to be imposed on us. You can't communicate in another language. So that was one way, I would say, robbing us of our own ways of communication, because a lot of foreign words don't suit us. And talk about that and talk about, say, like religion, Christianity. I have got no qualms with the religion myself, but of late, I'm not a Christian. I ceased being one a long, long time ago. But I couldn't understand why I can take anybody's belief, but I hate the idea of being told that now you've become a Christian, you're going to take a name like John, Charles. Oh, that really hurts me even today.
How did that come to be that they changed the name of the children to more American, British, I guess, names, but more standard Christian names?
Well, that is the brainwashing. You can only become a Christian by being baptized. And when you're baptized, you should acquire another name, a foreign name. Your first name should be John, Mary, whatever.
Oh, they issue you a name when you're baptized?
Oh, yeah. Even when children are born, if you're born in a Christian family, you are given a name that you should be able to. You should be actually when you attend these classes in catechism, as they call it, and you understand now about Christianity, you are of mind that can understand what it's all about, good morals. Then you are baptized, and when you're baptized, you definitely have got to take a foreign name. Your first name always changes.
Wow. And yet, if you're not baptized, then I'm sure there's a lot of repercussions on the other end.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all when you become of age, one becomes of age. Especially our generation, I realize people don't want to be called by foreign names. I mean, I've got my own names, which mean a lot. They have our names had our meanings. You're not just given a name. This name was written maybe to your great grandfather, to a certain
exactly.
event or whatever, and it reminds people of why you're called so and so.
Are you going to return to your given name?
Oh, yeah, yes. I hope, I can do that today, but in the next 2 years, by 2014, I'll definitely get rid of my first name, anyway. Officially.
Is there a lot of people who are doing that now, returning to their original names?
Well, I think people, basically, the good thing with us, when most of our generation, when we have families, we are not referred by names directly. You cannot call me Wainaina. You call me Father of Wainaina, and that's the respect we are given. So, and we call an elder, so and so. So we don't have... There's calling each other by first names. You refer to people by what they have achieved, like you are married, your son is married, so your mother of so-and-so or auntie of so-and-so. Formal and very, very, yeah.
Wow, it's just a completely different structure. At this point, go ahead.
No, sorry, carry on.
At this point, I'm going to pull Esther in and see if there's anything she wants to say so far on what's been said.
Okay. Thank you.
I think it's important. I mean, there's not too much I'd want to add, but I think it's important for people to understand some of the context as to why this whole situation has come about in terms of being publicized now. And that was certainly a question that came out in the court proceedings, of which I went to some of them here in the UK. Why now, after all these years, are Kenyans raising this question of justice? Well, the fact is it's not only now that they've been raising this question of justice. It's been an intergenerational call, if you like. However, there were some key things that took place in Kenyan society that I think made it much easier for the Mau Mau struggle and the history of Mau Mau and the Kenyan freedom struggle to be analysed and to be reflected on. And a key thing that I think we need to highlight is the fact that Mau Mau were banned. They were a proscribed organisation until around 2003, and I think Wainaina, or Charles, will be able
correct,
to
yeah.
confirm that. So even after independence, part of the damage continued to be done because people couldn't freely associate, they couldn't come together and organize, they couldn't really educate their children, there was no real formal inclusion of this history within the curriculum. And that's part of the neo-colonial legacies that Africans are still dealing with on the continent. So there is a perception that, oh, well, they had independence in, the 60s, 1963, I believe. So there was no real understanding of how much this history has impacted on subsequent generations. And Brother Wainaina has actually shared that his elder brother was detained in a detention camp. So you can see it's a very, very recent history.
Right. And people look at this and they say, well, it's in the 50s. That was a long time ago. But it's not when you have a person sitting right here who says, I saw my brother dealing with this. And people don't consider the generation right behind this and what they saw as children and how that affects the entire quality of their life.
That's right. It's not just about the individuals. It's about their families. It's about their loved ones. And it's about the destruction that was caused to not only families but whole communities.
And the history. I mean, when you're erasing a person's entire history before their eyes, and then you can't understand why they're fighting back.
That's
right. Because a lot of these people view their what they're bringing as so valuable that they can't comprehend why somebody wouldn't just run full force and thank them for bringing it.
Yeah.
It's such an arrogant attitude to have that our education and our way of being and our religion and everything that we are is so much better than anything that you are, you know, and we're here to save you.
Sure, and it's also important to recognize the impact that this then has in terms of the communities so affected, so that we begin to internalize these very, very genocidal and, systems of structural violence, and I think that also gets lost, because an argument could be made, that you were supposedly independent, which was meant to be a degree of freedom. You could have made changes, and maybe there was a lot more that could have been done, but equally, I think we have to be much more sensitive to the impacts of this history, and also the violence that accompanied it, and how when those who supposedly took over the reins of the colonial state apparatus in Kenya, when they actually took over the reins, they were also party to some of the continued oppression. And I think that is a wider lesson of what is independence, and can you really, affect change using the master's tools, as it were, you know?
Exactly. It's very hard to turn around genocide, depending on how deep they got into it before they lost their battle, which is what it kind of looks like to me here, is they did a strong push to wipe you off the map, and they ended up not winning. And so now they just want to forget about it because they didn't win, and to them it's done. But to the people who lived it, it's far from done. It's everywhere that you see. It's in the language that you don't have. It's in the songs. It's in the whole atmosphere.
Yeah, definitely. The people remember, and if the people remember, then it means it's an injustice that still needs to be remedied. It's a wrong that still needs to be made right.
And it takes generations to turn around genocide. It's not something that, we stopped killing you and tomorrow we're all supposed to dance in the street together and celebrate the fact that we're not killing you today. You know, those are serious things that create environments of PTSD that take generations to undo.
Yes. Absolutely.
Charles, can you tell us more about where Kenya is now because of this history and what they're trying to dig out of?
Sorry, can you repeat the question, please?
Can you tell You there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Can you tell us what this history of genocide created in Kenya that they're trying to dig out of today? Like, a lot of cultures that suffer this have drug problems, alcohol problems, and poor education, and a lot of different factors. What do you see that they're facing because of this?
In fact, a very good point to ask me that question. One of the reasons I got involved in Mau Mau Justice Network is to be able to educate, because I know a bit of the history. I would like to educate the younger generation, people like who are maybe in their whatever age, up to about 30, 40. Some of them don't even have the history. Maybe some of them are often during that time. I mean, they are like, they don't know much about the history, because it was actually, as Esther said before earlier on, that Mau Mau was a proscribed movement. We could not meet until 2003. we be a hard struggle, but went on in the parliament in that way back in Kenya, asking for unbanning of this movement. But because the first president, I think, had gone to bed at the time with the colonialists, there's no way that could have been undone. And that prevailed when the second president came into power. Now, until the third president now, who is the incumbent, unbanned it after a lot of pressure, now that's, we can be able to enjoy that. Now, coming back to your question in more detail, since we didn't have no land, especially our own people, we are actually connected to the earth very much. So that's where we get all our sustenance in terms of farming, getting crops, what have you, and educating our people. With that being displaced internally, as we say, by the virtue of the colonialism, we have been denied of the opportunity to develop ourselves. And to date, and quote me and you, anybody knows that during the last general elections, which happened in Kenya, December 2007, January 2008, there was a lot of violence. People lost their lives. Basically because voters said that the election was stolen by one leader and the other leader claimed no, he'd won the elections. But main trouble behind all these is to do with the land. Most of the internal displaced people are no longer in the original ancestral land. They were taken, uprooted, and some of them have been born and grown in different parts of Kenya. They speak right. The local dialect, local language, and that now fermented that reaction whereby they say, oh, you people came over here, you have taken over our land, you're farming here, and you are richer because some of us are very hard working. We became wealthy. And now they turned against, tribes turned against each other just because that same issue of divide and rule is still there. As a result, there were some groups that came up after who are actually not hardcore, but you would say people who are, came together as a movement to demand their rights. These are grandchildren of the veterans. Now they used to call them. There's a movement used to be called Mogiki, but they have been branded as bad elements. But they are not. The idea for them was they were just demanding jobs and opportunities, which they don't get
right. Because
wherever they go, bribe, give me this, you get that, and so forth. That were not getting anywhere in life, and that has now resulted in a lot of I read a lot about that in the newspapers and also on the radio. I listen to radios from back home on the net. And there's a problem of alcoholism. Men have become alcoholic because they have got no direction. They have lost their sense of direction. And all this to do with one man owning maybe miles and miles of land, not acres, miles of land. For land, you got people who don't even have a piece of land just because they were collaborators during that time and they were left with all the best land in the land. We don't have no land. So all these, there's a lot that needs to be healed, to be taken care of in the process of this reparation or bring the case to the court over here. Whatever may be gained out of it should go towards rehabilitating the young people, educating them. Let them understand where they're coming from and what they should be fighting for. It's such a hard road, I can tell you that. It requires a lot of education and patience because people are bitter even today.
Oh, I bet. Once you divide a country, it takes so many generations to find healing afterwards because you've created an imbalance that didn't exist before. And now there's always the government that occupied the new government that a lot of people call a puppet government, and then the real people who are fighting to get back what they originally had. So you always have that cycle of who are you and are you part of them, are you part of us? It's hard to know who is who, and it creates paranoia within the community.
Yes. That's why they fight to be elected, to be the leaders, because they'll always make rules in or legislature to actually safeguard themselves, not for the poor and oppressed. They always make those rules actually to help them in the process.
Right. So what control does the British still have over Kenya? Do they still have control?
Well, I think from what I gather around from people, you know, Kenya is like a darling of the British, and the Americans also love it because they've got an air a base there, and a military base, and the British have got a military base which have been there. They go, commanders go and train down there in the bushes, but they still got a base out there that they choose for training. And they love the place because they are those settlers, well, they call them settlers, but I call them colonialists, who never left. And you want to see the kind of lifestyle they lead. It's like they lead, it's a small Britain within Kenya. Those are no go areas. It's very, very posh. They live in one of the best suburbs. I mean, you won't believe in a third world country, as they call it, or in Kenya. You believe probably you're somewhere else. Very, very lush and very good place. So, yeah, they're still there. They still control because we get the aid, and they control how that is going to be spent. It's a hard load. Now they're being challenged by the Chinese, but the struggle is there.
Wow. Isn't it also the case about the control of the economy and the land? You know, it was mentioned the whole question of land dispossession and how that also contributed to some of the so-called ethnic violence that took place in Kenya in recent times. And I know Kenya has had an issue with land reform because it's operated a system of willing buyer, willing seller, which is a similar system that operates in South Africa, in Zimbabwe, in Namibia and other countries of the world. Then we also have to look at what is Kenya producing and what is it known for. And so the whole industry around tea and horticulture, these are not industries that Africans, really benefit from or control. So the whole question of economic empowerment and dispossession, I think, is a key area where the British, through various families and institutions, still wield an extreme amount of control.
Exactly.
So you haven't gotten your country back yet at all compared to what you have.
No,
they've got flag and anthem independence. maybe there might be some Kenyans who might feel offended by that. It's probably not that simplistic. However, the reality is that a lot of the systems that are still in place are still very much European systems. It's not African systems.
And
it's
once they're in, they never leave completely. They always put a public government in place, and then they pull the strings with funding and all kind of different ways. So there's a lot of different ways to control stuff.
A good point Esther raised there, the economic control. We are the second or third largest producer of fresh cut flowers in the world, the leaders in Africa. All the flowers come over here, you know, the supermarkets which buy them. And this is only a recent thing. In the past, where which is still going, one of the best teas and coffee. But who set the prices? They are set in London Stock Exchange, not ourselves. So, and people labor for that throughout, and we don't get nothing. I mean, you imagine probably what you produce, like the whole culture. You go to supermarkets in the UK, and you find a lot of produce from Kenya. I've actually come from the shop and just bought some French beans, and they're all Kenyan. So, and there's a lot that could be harnessed and made to benefit the people. A lot speaks to itself.
I want to talk about the different leaders, because in the United States we had Martin Luther King and then we had Malcolm X, who had two completely different philosophies in how to address the oppression they were facing. What type of leaders did the Mau Maus have, and who was opposing them?
The Mau Mau leaders had a vision, and they knew exactly what they wanted. As I say, keep saying, they wanted our land back, and they wanted freedom. That was crucial to whatever surrounded their culture, because our culture is all to do with the land, the freedom of movement. So we didn't have that. And they had a clear way of governance, because we, before the onset of the colonization or the advent of the white man in Kenya or in Africa, we had our own ways of governing from elders to the village, any cases that need to be settled or even marriages. We had every way enshrined with these stories or the way we had the custom is handed down. So we knew all about that. So the Mau Mau leaders wanting our freedom back was just to get back to a way of life. Of course, they would have changed to accommodate the Western way of world, but within their own terms. But because that was denied of them, the leaders now in power who took the freedom was allowed to us, that changed everything because they were still like puppets. Not like they were even wasn't that.
Right.
They were puppets of the colonialists. And they still did that until even today. We still have the same kind of leadership. Not current leadership, but the people who have benefited from the system are there in the parliament making these acts or laws which enable them just to protect themselves.
Who was one of the strong leaders of the Mau Mau?
Oh, well, the one who is famously known is Dedan Kimathi, or the late Dedan Kimathi. He was the actual field marshal. There are others who are historically, there's one like General China. And for your information, there's one of the strongest women who was there in the movement in the bush and still alive. It's Field Marshal Modoni today. And we have tried to get some interviews with her, but I'm here, but you know, she needs the person to coordinate that. There are a lot of leaders who are there. They knew the way of the way of governance, how they wanted the country to go. They're still there. And these are the elders. I keep saying we need to capture their original ideas, their original
thoughts,
the original, before they you know, they kind of pass on the torch.
Yeah, I love to do shows like that where you hear the real history, especially of the elders. It's so important to capture that while they're still here. Now, that one leader you spoke about, he was killed, right?
Yes. And that's Dedan Kimathi. He was actually, I understand, and it's been said that he was actually betrayed. And after being betrayed, he was captured. That you can some of his clips when he's in handcuffs, and he can be shown, or they can see those on YouTube. They are there, and they can be seen was alive. They say they hung him upside down. And we don't know where they buried his body today. No, but that's one of the things we are demanding to know, where his body was buried.
Nobody knows where he's buried?
Well, we want them to tell us because none of the Africans was there when that happened. So we want to know, somebody should know where that grave is. Whatever they buried him, we want to know. Those are the things we are demanding so that we can give him his due rights.
What I'm going to do now is I'm going to take a short break and play the song that you sent me, and then we'll come back and we'll talk some more, okay?
Thank you.
All right, we'll be right back.
Who is this man, Dedan Kimathi? He stood in the heart of the struggle, put a past his rebellion, against the masters, liberating Kenya from the British colonialist Mau Mau rebellion. Mau Mau rebellion. Mau Mau rebellion. Mau Mau rebellion.
very
Thank
good
you.
Song. Thank you for sending that to me.
Okay.
What I want to do now is touch base on the court case again. And one thing that it's very unusual to hear that something actually made it to court. I've heard of a lot of apologies around the world, and none of them made it to court. The court did everything in its power to keep them from getting there. So the fact that it's even accepted in the court system is amazing to me. So can you tell us some of the how this came to be and where it is in its process?
That over to me or to Edda?
Yeah, you.
Okay. Initially, at the moment, what people are fighting for a start, they are seeking apology. That's first and foremost that we are seeking. Good that once this Mau Mau movement was unbanned in 2003, that's when the process started. And they did not make it to court until 2009. That's when they came actually to ask. And when that was accepted, and then that was going to be heard. 2010, that was just the formal process which took place, I think that was in April 2010. And then they came back this year when now the judge decided that atrocities were, and they cannot let go, as you have heard from the lead counsel in the case. So that's in a nutshell, that's how it has happened. But a lot has happened to build up the case to that point because, as you know, they could not make it court anywhere, not in Kenya, not even anywhere else. They didn't even have the support of the government. So until then, that happened. Until when that happened, we had no way but just to swallow our grievances and sit tight. It's such a painful thing knowing that you can see whoever is ruling you in the country, like Kenya, we know. Somebody has just texted me, and it's one of our Mau Mau Justice Network, that's Karaoke. He asked me to remind everybody the people in power, the rulers, are basically the sons of the chiefs who are working hard by the colonialists. So you can imagine we are still under the same kind of yoke that ruled us from that time. And it's so painful unless we break this. And the more we try to break into the system, we are branded like dissident. They give us names in Kenya. We are tracked down and people just disappear. There's a famous forest called Karura in the outskirts of Nairobi where they disappear in that forest for no reason. So we know how this process has been very much against us, very people who made it for the Kenyans to enjoy the freedom they have today.
So it's still a very dangerous thing to fight.
It is indeed. It is very, very dangerous. Very dangerous and difficult.
So how did it get into court? How did they not block it somehow?
It's through the Kenya Human Rights. So they had to do that. And I understand it's supported from outside again. I don't know where the funds are coming from, but the whole idea is that this case was taken up by the Kenya Human Rights to be able to make the court. We got one of the lead counsels from Kenya who actually advised them, who is he's well known, Mr. Paul Moite. He's very, very good as a person I know personally, and he's been one of the people who actually, we'll call him one of the second liberators of Kenya, because when we attained independence, Mau movement was banned, and then the second president was even worse. Planted the country, killed and what have you, name it. We almost went down to the dogs, to be honest. It was very bad economically. And then when that president came to power, he unbanned the movement. And the second president was actually voted out of office by these very people, like the likes of Paul Moite, who went about and said, "Why we cannot live under one party state," and they call it democracy. There was only one party in the country. So that movement has taken a lot of people underground, and their books and minds where it was such a very sad, dark part of our history again. After the colonialism, we had the leader who was the president who said it's only one party state, and anybody wanting to be against his rule was an enemy of the state, and he was branded. They gave us various names, But it basically, you are a label, you are not part of their system, so you have to be locked up. And we've got people like who are known all over, Esther knows them, they are good writers. One of them is living in the U.S., Gogo Adiongo, it's a professor out there. We've got another giant called Maina Wakinyate and so forth. These sort of a lot has happened in the background. Even the late Nobel Peace Prize winner, Wangari Maathai, she was part of the people who actually forced the president at that time to accept that we cannot live under one-party state. As a result, that's how now the movement even gained more confidence after it was unbanned. So they were there, but were just sitting, waiting for the opportunity to come along. So that's how they were able to make it to court anyway.
One of the things that's completely different now, because they've been doing this for hundreds of years, is there are social networks now. And people kind of, use social network, the family and friends. But it's actually an extremely powerful tool to expose these kind of things. So people are seeing history that they never knew existed, because now the networks are interacting. Where before it was easy to go to a village and wipe them out and nobody even know they were gone. But now you can't do it because we're too interconnected.
It's too powerful, very connected and powerful.
Right, because now I know what happened, and I'm in America, where I would have never known without the social networks that this even existed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very
Thanks
powerful
for you
that
for
we connecting. All cross over and protect each other.
Absolutely.
So, and I'm so happy y'all came on the show that we can get this information out, because many people around the world have suffered at the hands of the same people. And if we all gather together and collectively have our stories, then that's enough power, I think, to take down this kind of behavior from ever happening again.
Thank you.
Esther, is there anything you want to add right now?
Well, I think I just wanted to touch a bit on the court case.
Okay.
And you was, commenting about, they're normally kept out of the courts. I think it's important to recognize that there has been a huge legal battle around even getting this case into court, and the different hurdles that the claimants have been put through in order for the case to just get this far, which is simply, and I say that not in a flippant way, but what they have achieved is the right to sue the British government for acts of torture that were committed during the state of emergency. Now, that has been heralded as a huge victory, and on one level, if we look at it comparatively and if we look at the balances of power and how difficult it is to get cases into court, then we might see it as a victory. However, if we take a longer range perspective on this case, and if we look at the whole context of the liberation struggle in freedom that still continues, we then have to begin to question, what type of victory is this? And what kind of people, what kind of justice system makes, clearly victims, survivors, go through all of these hoops just to get a declaration that they have the right to sue? And for me, what the case threw up more than anything else as a jurisconsult, so I'm not just looking at the letter of the law and what's happening, I'm also looking at the spirit of the law and the application of the law. I'm looking at how law itself has been part of the injustice, how law itself has been used to oppress people. And I believe we need to look much more broadly around why it is we continue to acquiesce to justice systems, so-called, or legal systems that actually do not treat people equally. That's a wider philosophical but practical question that we have to begin to grapple with. Are we going to continue to subject ourselves to these court processes? Also, having been in the court proceedings for some of the time, What I also noticed was how alienating the British legal system is. For a start, you had the claimants who came, gave their evidence. In fact, they were deposed. They had to basically swear an affidavit and so forth and confirm that statements that they had given were true. But essentially, the court proceedings are conducted in English. English is not the first language of any of the claimants. So they had to give the few bits of testimony that they were able to give through translators. And it just felt so alien. Most of the people in the court were not African, and most of the legal professionals were not African. And so once again, it does speak to wider issues of what kind of justice is this? When three test cases, if you like, have been singled out from the rest of the, you know, potential victims. And if anything, maybe three people, the three remaining, because there has been deaths along the way, and I'm sure part of the strategy is to drag this case out for as long as possible, unfortunately. And, you know, if we remember what Wanaina or Charles has said, that he himself was a victim. And, you know, there were other victims. You know, it was a societal injustice that took place. So there's a number of questions around power and who has the power to define what is legal, who has the power to hold perpetrators to account. And is this going to be a victor's justice where the very oppressors and perpetrators and their descendants are actually setting the parameters by which the victims now have to seek recourse to them to give them some modicum of justice?
Right, because these apologies that are issued worldwide, and there have been a number of them, turn out to be a weapon that's used later on to continue to destroy the next generation. So the apology itself can sometimes make society feel like it's all over with and we can all move on happily into the sunshine. But when you've done this to a whole community, then you also have to accept responsibility that it takes several generations.
That's right.
For that. But most of society that this has happened to, they're still coming after them. They're still taking their legs out from under them at every turn and then saying, why don't you stand up? And they're like, I can't stand up because you keep kicking my legs out from
under
them. That's
it. You cripple people and then you want to penalize them and discriminate against them for actually handicapping them and disabling them.
Right. And that's the system that has to change. And I think now that we're crossing each other's networks more, it's going to be extremely hard for them to continue this kind of mindset. One thing that crossed my mind, though, when I was thinking about the repercussions of this court case, is they went to several countries and did the same thing. So if they're able to sue in this case, it could very well set them up for other people from other countries coming and asking for apologies as well.
Technically, yes, it could. However, my reading of this case and the political dimensions, because law is also about power. It's also political. It's not just a straight legal process. And it is about how have Africans been able to enforce their power in the international arena. And we could argue that despite a huge movement around decolonization, but right now, as global players, many African nations remain relatively powerless. Now, technically, as I said, this case could set a precedent, and certainly the mainstream media also promotes that narrative. However, what we do know is that there is a likelihood that this case will be settled. The claimants, it seem to want a settlement because, you know, obviously they're elderly people. They don't want to be engaged in unending litigation, and they are at a time of their life where they're beginning to experience extreme health challenges. You know, there's obvious economic challenges and so forth. So if there is a settlement, my concern is that the settlement will be on terms that will not actually make it such a precedent-setting case for other
right.
victims who've also experienced colonial settler colonialism.
Yeah, they're
that
famous.
Is the,
right.
That is the challenge that we face, and that is why
right.
I feel the only way to guard against that is if this case is internationalized and is if a political movement is galvanized to actually expose
right.
the injustices of even the process and create the public climate and the moral climate where the powers that be cannot just continue business as normal.
Exactly, exactly. And
thank
so
you.
Even
that's
something
very
like what
point.
We're doing now is doing that. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, I'm just saying I wholeheartedly agree with what Esther is saying there. It's the only way forward in this matter. It's settlement out of the cause. We're just, you know, just pulling the wool over our eyes, and then nobody else knows about it. We can only hear it from close friends and so forth. But, you know, it will not come to light. And as you said before, why not for the power of a networking network? You never have known about us, but you found
right.
us on Facebook, and here we are talking, and we
yeah.
are we're trying to sensitize
yeah.
the whole
right.
issue. Yeah.
It sounds like
yeah.
the
now,
court case has lasted longer than the rebellion did.
No, definitely no.
Because
I
thought
see,
the rebellion went like 7 years or something.
Well, that was just an emergency. But otherwise, they call it the rebellion. That is between the 1952 to 1960. That was 7 years. At the time that there was the total emergency in the country, movement, what have you. But otherwise, our rebellion started way back in late. That is, people realized how they have been robbed of their land. So Milo, we were just... That was fomenting all along, yeah. But, you know... When it came to the light, yes, it was about that the same time, says, you know, 7 years, when that was the darkest period of the Kenyan history during the colonial time.
And what do they do to explain why it takes so long? Do they explain that at all?
Well, as I understand it, well, Esther might be able to expound that on that better than I can. But I just believe it's a legal process whereby they come and say, even right as Esther said right now, we have got now been granted the right to sue. But that doesn't mean that they have accepted that we shall go ahead with the court case. I understand the government is appealing. And for your information, Esther, you might just want to highlight what you told us last Sunday during your training session that you are holding with us, whereby you wrote to the Attorney General and then whatever came out of it, the kind of the correspondence, because that is very much in tune with what our book is all about.
Yeah.
Over to you, Esther.
Yeah. It was really around the whole question of statute of limitations, but as has been pointed out, the government is appealing, and we know that could take some time. And these are all technical maneuvers that powerful institutions and governments will use to just try and actually throw a spanner in the works. I think also that there's the wider issue of what a settlement might look like. And even though there's been a lot of media attention around this case, I would like to draw listeners to a statement that was put out by the solicitors in this case, which is a firm called Leday & Co., where they pointed out that this particular case, which if you wanted to Google it, it's actually called Matua and Others v. Foreign and Commonwealth Office. So if you just Googled that, you'd find the case. And you could also look at the website of the law firm, which is called Leday & Co., spelled Leigh Day & Co. However, there was a statement that they had made on one of their documents where they said that, you know, this is not a historical reparations claim in general terms. The victims are not seeking to make a political point about colonialism. This case is about torture, and it is driven by the surviving victims who live with the consequent injuries to this day. So it's important to recognize the political context of the case. It is not making a general point about colonialism, which is what many of us would like it to do. It's actually a very specific case that is looking at torture, which, you know, were crimes committed against various claimants, but there are three in this case surviving. And therefore, you have a right to reparations in any way if you experience torture. So it's recognizing that even if there is some victory, it can only, according to how the case has been constructed, be a narrow victory, according to these three claimants. In effect, the British government would only, if it went to trial and the British government lost, technically they would only need to meet the concerns and the demands as they relate to those three claimants.
Three individuals, not overall.
No, but it's important to recognise that the veterans, I believe the Veterans Association that deals with supporting the claimants as well, have subsequently met and come up with a demand for a negotiated settlement, which is a lot better than what the original, negotiated settlement was purported to be. And they have seven key demands, which I would just like to highlight. One or two have already been mentioned. First one is a public acknowledgement of wrongdoing by the British during the emergency rule and an apology. Second, Britain to fund a comprehensive study by international and Kenyan experts of the Mau Mau War and to compile an accurate and comprehensive report of all the victims, those who were killed, those who were detained, those who were confined in emergency villages, the Mau Mau fighters, those mainly women who ensured the vital supplies such as food, etc., to the fighters. Three, the erection of a wall of honour at Uhuru Gardens on which the names of all killed and detained will be inscribed. Four, truth about General Kamati's burial and or remains. Five, a medical fund to cater for the medical needs of the veterans. Six, Britain to agree and to assist and to support the government of Kenya in resolving the historical injustices on land, which is critical. And seven, Britain to make a proper and full compensation to all the victims.
Right. And those seem to me to be very reasonable demands. Now, I hear that there was a lot of documents that they took a lot of notes and kept a lot of records. Is that true?
Yes, there was a lot of documentation. The British have been meticulous record keepers and kept very, very detailed records of many of the injustices. However, they tried to use archaic laws to basically prevent many of these documents being released into the public domain.
Yes.
And they have not necessarily won that strategy because they have been compelled to release documents of some of the atrocities that they've committed, not only in Kenyan, but in many of the other territories where they actually colonized the peoples there.
And that in itself is worth the case. To have those documents released is more important, in my mind, than the apology, because it shows that, because there's always, anytime you have a case, there's always the other end where they're like, no, that's not true. But when you have documents released that describe the tortures or describe what was done, that's a powerful thing that can always be used later on down
it the is, road. And it's about exposing what they've been doing, and that's why I feel that the government, if they do not win their appeal, that they would also want to have a settlement, because if it goes to trial, then it's more information that's going to come out into the public domain. They really do not want people knowing, on a large sort of scale, what they did.
And you would think they would go ahead and settle this just for that piece alone, so that they wouldn't risk any of these documents being leaked out.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. But we're still dealing. For some of us, we have to take, as I said, not only a long range view on this, but we also have to be guided by our historical experience. And there is no real track record of Britain treating Africans and people of African descent or any other colonized people with that degree of equality and recognition of their justice struggles. So we have to be guided by our interaction with the British, with Europeans, from the time we encountered them. And it was their same laws that they used to carve up Africa at the Berlin Conference of 1884, 1885. They actually instituted laws around that. They instituted laws to justify colonialism. And now we're actually utilizing the same legal frameworks to try and hold them to account, which is very, very problematic, actually.
Charles, is there anything you want to add now?
Well, all I can say is I can only just to touch a little bit on what has been talked about the court case, the negotiated settlement. I'll only try and say we got a call to action on what we need to do as Mau Mau Justice Network. But the lawyer for the claimant did actually outline what the demand for a settled or negotiated settlement is. And if you don't mind, bear with me for a minute, I'll just outline that. One is they require a public acknowledgement of wrongdoing by the British during the emergency rule and an apology.
Hey,
second,
Charles,
Britain to fund...
not to interrupt you, but I know that you dropped off the line.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
I already
stated that. Yeah, so she read that when you dropped off the line, she was reading that.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That's all right.
Yeah,
then
I've already let them
to...
know about what the demands are for a settlement. Yeah.
Which is extremely important to put those out there. And that's what's so sad is they're very reasonable demands, but these people don't give an inch on anything. They're takers. They don't give. And so it's up to us to put them in a situation where they have no choice, because you cannot appeal to their humanity, because if they had it, they wouldn't have done what they did to begin with. So the system itself does not have humanity. It's there to protect them.
That's right. And we have to learn from history. And it was Castro that said history will absolve me, and actually history will absolve us, because there's another saying that history is best qualified to reward our research. So yes, we are definitely in solidarity with the, you know, personally many of us as African people in solidarity with this struggle of Kenyans, or Africans in Kenyans, I would say. However, we have to internationalize the struggle, because if we do so, we will be in a stronger position to force these powers to actually, act according to not only the letter but the spirit of the law.
Right. And that's why I think it's important for the different networks, and I'm part of a lot of different ones, and to come together that are fighting the same type of treatment, where you can take children and do whatever you want to them and not educate them and marginalize them within every aspect of their life. So if all the networks who have experienced this in their history, and there are millions of them, come together, these powers are actually a very small percent of the people. It's just they position themselves in a way that to have the appearance of more power, but collectively they cannot defeat all of us.
No, that's it. And I think that we've already begun to see that actually with the original proposals or options for justice that were drawn up by the legal team, which, in my view, were not options for justice at all, because one of the options was basically saying that the claimants would want to build on the existing programs that the British government has in operation in Kenya. which, you know, is a very neo-colonialist framework. And I feel as a result of some of the campaigning that took place at the grassroots level, as a result of exposing this, as a result of critiquing it, as a result of using new media and actually doing lots of advocacy around this issue, there is now a much more reasonable and fair and just negotiated settlement that is on the table.
Right.
So I think we can, you know, recognize that we're already beginning to influence that process, and but we need to do more. We need to influence the process much more.
So what do you want my listeners to take away as far as how they can help you? What do you want them to know?
We'll pass that over to Charles Winaina.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's a straightforward. As I said, we've got a call to action, and what we really want is to internationalize our group and the case itself. And apart from that, is as Esther has pointed out there, we are far too many out there, and we have not come together internationally to actually support each other. So small movement doing their own thing, but if we join forces together in solidarity, yes,
exactly.
These issues can be handled, can seem to be done. But when we are small, we are being crushed because we are far too divided. So that's one thing I like, as we come and support those who are listening, and they are out here, say, in the UK. But we've got connections, like you're out there, we've got others in other countries, and that's what we like to do. They don't have to rely on us only. They can form their own groups wherever they are. As long as they are supporting the same cause, yes, make the noise wherever they are, and together we shall be able to overcome.
Absolutely.
And the other thing is,
yeah,
is a lot of myth surrounding the Mau Mau movement and so forth. People don't know. They need to be educated, be informed. And as a result of that, people know the true facts. Because, as I say, there's a lot of meat. You are barbaric, what have you. But you come to think of it. Who caused that to happen within the indigenous people? Is the person who came to sit on them to come to the country and take and make them less than human beings? And that's what we're trying to come out and say, no. It's not something we ask for. You are forced to do it. So it's
right.
Not be criminalized.
Exactly.
Yeah. I also feel that there's the need for us to look at what this case means for the whole notion of global justice, and to look at, as part of internationalizing this struggle, whatever happens within the confines of Mutu and others, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, there are going to be huge legacy questions. And clearly there are other peoples who've experienced similar injustices,
right,
to greater or lesser degrees.
Yes.
And so we do have a unique opportunity. I think the conscience of humanity, the peoples who really do want to see a world that is based on true justice and the operation of just law as opposed to unjust law, we need to look at how we can utilize this case and other cases and other justice campaigns out there to begin to play a greater role in refashioning law and justice systems and frameworks. So, for instance, I'm part of a coalition called PARCO, the Pan-African Reparations Coalition in Europe, and we have been campaigning and advocating around the whole question of Pan-African reparations for global justice. And one of the measures that we have been popularizing and trying to build the power to bring about is we need to be thinking about an alternative tribunal, an alternative court system, apart from the World Court, and a system that would be made up of judges from the various nations and peoples that have experienced colonialism, because international law, a lot of the time, has been European law or Eurocentric law that has been globalized. And we need to create a wider system of justice that really is based on our own justice principles, as opposed to working within systems and frameworks that we do not control and we did not originate. And I know Indigenous peoples in the Americas have a principle around what they call seven generations.
Yes.
So whatever we do today, whatever settlements we make, whatever policies we develop, we must look at what will be the impact seven generations. And those are the kind of principles that we want in a truly international justice system. So there's work for us to do in building our capacity, but building our power to be able to develop alternatives, such as the Nuremberg Tribunal, which is a problematic tribunal, but essentially there is a need for new law and new justice systems that we have to be part of creating as well.
Yes, a global shift in humanity.
Definitely, definitely, because otherwise we're constantly going to the perpetrators, going into their terrains of power and seeking to negotiate with them on their terms. We have to redefine the whole landscape of justice.
Exactly.
I agree wholeheartedly.
I want to speak, if you can, Esther, on intergenerational trauma, because to me this court case hinges on these people staying alive. But in my mind, we need to start connecting these things more to multigenerational and say, and the community as well, and saying, when you create this, the repercussions are far-reaching, but especially to your children that are directly impacted. And the settlement should extend to them as well, because when you damage the parent, you damage the child.
Exactly, and that's why the context is problematic of this existing case. It does not take into consideration the intergenerational dimensions of what happened to the claimants and also how that has gone on to impact some of their children. And also, you know, some of them were prevented from even procreating as a result of the extreme, brutal and sadistic acts of torture that were committed against men and women. I mean, very, very sadistic stuff. So, yes, we need to look at intergenerational trauma. We need to look at the intergenerational legacies. And that's why this whole case also, I think, offers Kenyans and other Africans, as well as other peoples of conscience around the world, to re-examine what is this legacy? How have we been shaped or harmed, you know, depending on who we are? So there's also an argument that has come up from some reparations groups, for instance, that the harm wasn't only done to African society and African people. A harm has also been done to the masses of Caucasian or European people who have been denied a knowledge of this history.
That is true.
And therefore have not been taught properly, and therefore have been raised in a society that promotes white supremacy. So that damage is it's very, very extensive. If we are not, taking the responsibility to correct injustices at each generation's level. So we have to look at this in a multifaceted way. It is multigenerational.
Yes.
It is also, multidisciplinary in terms of the impact of what the damage and what the repair, therefore, must be. And reparations is about making repair. It's about making amends. It's not just about financial compensation.
Right.
And there's a whole, need for reparations across not only Kenyan society, but across many of our societies where we are. And we can all be engaged in that repair.
Yeah, as a white person learning this history, it's very hard to watch your own race create so much destruction and yet know that there's good people within that race that would never harm anyone, but they don't even know the history of it. And so when you try to explain that, once you begin to know, then you're caught in that middle world where what you're saying to them is so foreign and to other people is very common. There's two different worlds that exist, and try to merge the two and explain the history, it's very complex when they've been so indoctrinated into the other history.
Yeah, definitely.
Is there, Charles, is there anything else you'd like to say before we wrap up?
Nah,
nothing more like to add. I mean, we could debate about this the whole night, but I really appreciate honestly it this kind of debate whereby people start talking about it and it goes on and on and on, because you want to know. If I start telling you, find the details of other things, you want to get into it and know the details. It's, some of them are very sad. Even you can't even talk about them on the air. They're just too painful, too difficult even to run the words. But we hope that the process we have taken right now, the process that have been taken by the veterans through the Kenya Human Rights Commission to seek for justice or apologies and whatever comes with it, we hope this will be the best path that has been taken to help, as Esther has said, other people, not only Africans, but even for them, for Preza himself to see the much information that he has been denied of, and therefore we can actually sort of, when that is mentioned within the circles, like where in this Western world people think, oh, don't mention about Mau-Mau, those who are criminals, who are, you know, whatever. But people will start associating and realizing that we actually were the victims, not the ones who actually committed the atrocities, but we were posting to them. Yeah, so there's a long process of educating the masses, campaigns, whatever, name it, any form of information, knowledge that you can actually use to disseminate to the people out there, the better. And you've done wonderful for getting in touch with us and being able to expose us that part of the world and with your network or your group. And therefore, we shall be in one, we shall have the solidarity that we need, because if this case can set a precedent, then we know. At least there's nowhere for the pressure to hide. We know that. But it's a struggle.
And I'll be watching, too, and spreading the information within my network, because it's very important for us to take care of each other. Esther, is there anything else that you want to say before we close?
I think enough has been said, but hopefully we will, you know, continue the dialogue, and we must continue the sharing of knowledge and information, and also strategies around what various peoples and groups who have experienced historical and contemporary oppression are doing. And I think, you know, the final thing then I probably need to say is that we need to remain positive, because sometimes, you know, all of this oppression and trauma can take its effect and its toll on communities, but we have to be guided by the best of those that our communities and our struggle has produced, and we must use that as a lamplight to our future. That's, I think, the last thing I need to say, that we have to win, you know, we have to win. And we are the ones, you know, that are going to have to make the changes. We are going to have to be the ones who ensure that this doesn't ever happen again. So it's also on us. It's not just about what previous generations did or didn't do. It's about the responsibility that we have to take for actually being part of the alternative now.
And what do you want to say to the next generation? Your hopes. What are your hopes?
Oh, wow. Ooh. Yeah, that's wow. I mean, the hopes are. Yeah, that's my hope is that really we have so much we have a rich history, we have a rich legacy, and there is so much value in actually being alive and living our lives with purpose. So to the next generation, I would say, discover your mission, fulfill it. And don't betray it. You know, Frantz Fanon, you know, told us that it is about each generation discovering their mission.
Each generation has a piece in the collective history, and it's their responsibility to pick this truth up and carry it forward to protect their children.
Yeah. I think it was Fanon or Baldwin, James Baldwin. But yeah, we all have to. Yeah, we all have to just play our role.
Yes.
And if we all played our role, then we could, you know, make those changes. And that might sound idealistic.
But it's very true.
And it's, And it probably is. However, we've always been guided, I think, each generation by the vision that we have gleaned from previous generations.
Absolutely. Well, thank you both for coming on. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
And please consider me a source for anything you need. If you need to get a message out, I'm here. Just contact me and welcome to the Fire Talk family.
Thank you
very much.
All right. Y'all have a wonderful day, and thank you for coming.
All right. You too.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.